Hello from the Talking Information Center, and welcome to The Poet's Voice, a program supported by America's Hometown Laureates, Incorporated, and dedicated to the place of poetry in our lives and communities. Today, poet Brian Mosier, that's me, will interview poet Gene Kreeling. We both live in southeastern Massachusetts, and our poems have appeared in numerous print and online journals. Between us, we've published 7 collections of poetry, with more in progress. Today, I'll be talking with Jean about her insights and opinions concerning poetry, and we'll hear her read some of her poems. Welcome, Jean.
Thank you, Brian. Happy to be here.
Excellent. Jean, to get us started with some conversation and some poetry, please tell us about one of your favorite things to write about and read us one of your poems on that topic.
There is a handful of subjects that I keep returning to over and over again. You might call them obsessions. I think obsession fuels our drive to write, to make sense of the experience or to preserve it. I write a lot of poems about the beach, a lot of poems about my family. But one that I have been writing about since I was first serious about writing poetry is the topic of classical music. I write poems that imagine the perspective of the composer and the listener and the performer as well. This one imagines the perspective of an alto in the chorus of a performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And I have had the privilege of being this alto. This is a sonnet called In the Alto Section, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. You sit behind the orchestra, spellbound by complex chemistry you've heard before, a measured mix of breath and time and sound decreed by small black icons in the score. You recognize these runes, for you've been trained to translate this arcane calligraphy to be a catalyst for unexplained excursions into immortality. At last you stand. At last you get to sing, your mortal mid-range voice admitting you to this inspired amalgam. Finally, your notes are needed for the rendering of gold. Believe and count, and on your cue, supply the center of the alchemy.
That's beautiful. I loved arcane calligraphy, and I loved spinning into gold. There's something magical about music, right? Especially live performed. Sort of an alchemy sort of a thing. Very nice. Thinking about the power and place of poetry, how did it first enter your life? Who introduced you to poetry, and when did you start writing?
It certainly started in my childhood home. I grew up in a family of readers. My mother in particular was a voracious reader. She read mostly novels, but she also enjoyed poetry, and she could recite a couple of things. I remember in particular that she recited Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, The Children's Hour, which begins, "Between the dark and the daylight, when the night is beginning to lower, comes a pause in the day's occupations that is known as the children's hour."
And wonderful.
The music of that and the imagery of this poem, that's the sort of thing that I heard in my early childhood years.
Wonderful.
Years later, I had a brilliant high school English teacher who invented a course called Writing for Pleasure. She instructed us in how to write various pieces, an essay, an argument, a poem, but each of us was free to draw up a contract of exactly what we would write during the semester. And she brilliantly figured out how to assess each individual student's work, and we contracted for a certain number of pieces at a certain number of grades for an A, otherwise a B, and so forth and so on. Anyway, she introduced me to the sonnet, and I have not been able to stop writing them since. I did stop writing poetry with any sort of focus or seriousness for several years, mostly while I was getting established in my career as a professor. I wrote sort of idly as a sort of journaling or therapy, which it still is. But my career actually drove me back to poetry. I was, until my recent retirement, a professor of music history. And I had to write academic articles about this music that I loved. And I was required to write with objectivity and close, precise analysis. And I liked doing that. It was satisfying, but also a little frustrating, because objective and analytical doesn't quite capture my experience of the music. So I wrote a couple of sonnets about individual pieces like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. They got published, and that encouraged me to write about my other obsessions and all kinds of things. And I guess that's been going on. I've been sort of serious about it for about 25 years now.
Wow. Yeah, I can see how trying to write in that really academic way about something as magical as music could be stultifying.
Right.
Jean, if you would, who are some of your favorite poets and why and how they've influenced you?
I'm going to name three, but the first one I'm naming on the strength of a single poem. And this is another story about a wonderful teacher. When I was in the seventh grade, our English teacher, Mrs. Hill, walked into the room, and it happened to be late autumn, a really dismal gray day. She walked in and pulled down the window blinds. She lit a candle, turned off the lights, sat down on the edge of her desk, and started reading aloud to us, "Once upon a midnight dreary, as I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, as I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door." And I think that's as far as I can go with Edgar Allan Poe's poem, The Raven.
Right.
That poem just, and that experience, the way she presented it, just stayed with me and really had a lot to do with why I love poetry. And that experience was so important to me that decades later, I wrote a poem about it. excuse me. The second poem I'm going, the second poet I'll name is Edna St. Vincent Millay, who wrote in the early 20th century. She wrote in various forms, and she wrote some free verse, but I think she's best known as a writer of sonnets, and love sonnets in particular. By her lifetime, the sonnet was already a very old-fashioned form, but she imbued it with a modernist slant. Her love poems are very frank, very candid. One of them begins, "I shall forget you presently, my dear," basically about the fleeting nature of love. But she also felt very deeply. So what I've tried to learn from her is to use the sonnet form and forms in general any way I want to say whatever I want. She gave me that degree of freedom. And the third poet who's been, excuse me, very important to me is Rina Espaillat, who is still with us. She's in her 90s. She lives in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and she's a friend. I knew her work and much admired her work before I met her, and I'm privileged now to be her friend and to have participated with her in a workshop of several very fine poets. And as you know, getting feedback from your peers and, you know, laying it out and being vulnerable and being told what's wrong with your poem is very valuable. And Rina is wonderful at that. She writes mostly in forms. And I really, as is already apparent, I really enjoy the music of a formal poem. But in her poems, you are aware of rhyme. You are aware of regular rhythms. But you are at least as aware of the substance of the poem. The form does not dominate in any way. And she writes about absolutely everything in traditional forms. She wrote an entire poem about her bra. Mm. She writes about her family, spirituality, the outdoors, a little bit of political angles in her poems. So I try to learn from her to write in form, again, about anything I want, but in a very conversational tone. Her words are very down to earth, very relatable, I guess would be the word. So from all of these poets, I'm trying always to learn. As you know, it's an ongoing process.
Absolutely. So you've mentioned sonnets a couple of times, and I know I think almost all the poems that I've read of yours or heard you read, you've called either sonnets or villanelles. And I appreciate what you said a moment ago about the rhyme and the structure of these formal poems not getting in the way or not mm-hmm. being distracting, because that's so often the case, right?
Right.
In any event, how do you think about the shape a poem should take? How do you choose which form to use for a particular poem? And are there other particular elements that are important to you, other poetic elements that are important to you?
I want to say first that what draws me to form is partly the music of it, the sound, mm-hmm. but also that very challenge mm-hmm. To have a balance between the music and the substance. You, as you probably know, you can adhere to all of the poetic rules of a form and produce something that is not very poetic at all. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody wants, or I don't want, a nursery rhyme or a greeting card
right.
verse. So sometimes it feels like doing a crossword puzzle, getting things to fit. So I love the challenge of it. The sonnet is a very versatile form. It's only 14 lines, so you are required to be very concise. You want to make absolutely sure that there is not one unnecessary word in there. And also, a sonnet generally has what's called a turn, about two-thirds of the way through, at which point the poet starts to explore another side of the argument or another aspect of the image or another perspective. In the poem that I read about the performer in the Beethoven Symphony, about the first two-thirds is about the alto sitting behind the orchestra and being aware of this magnificent music around her. And then about two-thirds of the way through, she stands up and gets to sing. So it's a slightly different perspective. Mm-hmm. It used to be that sonnets were generally considered to be the right vehicle for love poems, but you can write a sonnet about anything. I've written sonnets about ceiling fans that I think are better than that might suggest. The villanelle, it requires so much repetition that I usually use it for a subject that itself has something to do with repetition. I recently wrote one about an elderly man who falls a lot. Mm-hmm. And so the phrase, he falls again, recurs several times, mirroring the meaning of the poem. Mm-hmm. The form can match the meaning or the idea. A rondeau is another favorite form of mine. It requires less repetition, but it's more rigorous in the rhyme scheme. There are only two end rhymes that you get to use. So that's a huge challenge. And in both the rondeau and the villanelle, part of the challenge is creating a balance between the repetition and variation. Because each repeated phrase, when it recurs, is in a slightly different context. So it has a slightly different meaning. Sometimes it's even punctuated differently because it functions so differently. I know that a lot of poets feel that forms, traditional forms, rhyme, meter, and so forth, it's too restrictive. And I would direct those folks to the great William Wordsworth, who wrote a poem whose first line is, "Nuns fret not at their convent's narrow room." And it goes on to say that if you choose your prison, it is not a prison at all, and in fact frees you from what Wordsworth calls the weight of too much liberty. And thinking in terms of a rhyme scheme and regular meter has forced me to consider words and phrases and even ideas that might not have occurred to me if I weren't trying to work within that form. So it works for me, and it's something I love to do.
Fascinating. The prison of too much freedom, was that the phrase?
The weight of too much liberty.
Fascinating. Gene, we both know that poems come from many different places, maybe a memory, maybe an image, a phrase. Would you please read us a poem of yours and tell us its origin story? You can either tell us the story first and then the poem, or vice versa, whatever feels right.
I would love to do that. I mentioned my obsessions earlier. All I have to do is walk down to the beach, which is not too far from my house, and I'll end up writing a beach poem. I once wrote a poem based on about a two-second image of a man driving a truck too fast down my street. But I'm going to read a poem that has a somewhat unusual stimulus, I think. It came from a visit to my parents' house many years ago, and while I was there, I took a walk through their neighborhood. It was just before sunrise, and the houses were very close together, and it occurred to me as I walked that it must be garbage day in this neighborhood, because all the garbage bins were lined up along the curb, and the houses are close together, so the garbage bins are fairly close together, and they're all in the same spot at the end of the driveway, and they're all dressed the same, and I shouldn't say that, I've given away part of the metaphor. They all look the same, and they seem to be very patient and dutiful. They reminded me of soldiers.
Okay.
And so I wrote this poem called 5 a.m. Sentries. Boxy bins on wheels line the pre-dawn curbside. Wednesday morning soldiers at mute attention, bearing someone else's detritus, brooking zero dissension. They prefer this earliest pickup hour, atmospheric camouflage grimly keeping grimy lids and uniforms darkly hidden while the world's sleeping. Not quite proud, they're dutiful. They stand firm, though sheepish, slightly mortified, blushing dark gray, grateful for their cushy, if dull, assignment, guarding the driveway.
That's wonderful. Fun and playful. But again, I see where the inspiration sort of sprung up. Fantastic. Gene, we're down to sort of the last few minutes here, and they will be all yours. Could you please read us a few more of your poems, say a few words about each, and if appropriate, tell us what book they could be found in?
I would love to. I think I've mentioned that one of my obsessions is the beach, the ocean. I'm going to read a sonnet from my book called Shared History, which contains a section called Sea Sonnets, several sonnets, all about the ocean or the beach. This one reflects the perspective of a man who apparently has made a big mistake. And so his response to the ocean is a little unusual, I think. This is called The Roaring. The wind pulled at his hair. The cold spray stung his brow. The sand blew in his eyes. And this felt just right for a fool like him who'd flung his last chance past the breakers. An abyss as deep as any ocean soon would claim what future he had left. He heard derision in crashing waves that seemed to roar his name, condemning him and his reckless decision. Who knew the ocean would be so unkind would salt regrets, leave rages newly stirred. Enough. He went home, left the sea behind, and poured himself the liquid he preferred. He drank some scotch, then shuffled off to bed. But he still heard the roaring in his head.
Wow. I really heard the music in that one.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And we don't know the tragic mistake that he has made. You kept that secret. I like that.
A little bit of mystery.
I like that.
This same book, Shared History, has a section of travel poems. And I was fortunate enough to be in Scotland several years ago and to walk through what's called the Salisbury Crags. It's a bunch of huge volcanic hills within sight of Edinburgh Castle. And there's a spot on one of them known as Arthur's Seat, allegedly because that's where King Arthur spent some time. Arthur's Seat is mentioned in the poem. And I also mention the thistle in this poem, which is the emblem of the Scottish monarchy. And there's another phrase that needs explanation. A fourth wind refers to the Firth of Forth, a sort of inlet or estuary in Edinburgh. This is a rondeau, which means that the opening phrase will be heard again about halfway through and again at the end. In this case, the opening phrase is, "Along these crags." The Salisbury Crags, Edinburgh, Scotland. Along these crags, near Arthur's Seat, you watch your own slow tourist feet connect the dots of random stones, sidestepping falls and broken bones. Then you look up and see, complete, an epic realm. Green hillsides meet a gray stone castle. Down the street, a palace preens. A fourth wind moans along these crags, chastising those who fear defeat by pebbly paths. Small perils greet the hiker, while time's rigor hones a city's pride. The thistle throne's high heather nods, and lost hearts beat along these crags.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. A very helpful source for poetry, a common stimulus, is art. Ekphrastic poetry, poetry written about mostly the visual arts. I'm going to read an example of that from my book, Arts and Letters and Love. This was inspired by a painting of Mary Cassatt's called Reading Le Figaro, Le Figaro being a French newspaper. The painting shows a very dignified woman sitting in an easy chair next to, and she's reading the newspaper. She's very close to a wall upon which hangs a mirror. So I've tried to imagine what this woman in the chair might have been thinking about the mirror. And I'm afraid my title gives it away. This is a poem in rhymed couplets. She prefers the newspaper. After Mary Cassatt's reading Le Figaro. Mirror, mirror on the wall, I'll read news of scandal, brawl, storm, and death, but I will not turn to look at you. I've got more important things to see than well-coiffed and roughly me. I'm more curious than vain, and of course you can't explain politics, finance, or war, so you're easy to ignore. I sit in a comfy chair, but I think, inquire, and care. You reflect without reflecting on a thing. I'm not objecting. You look fine. You're nicely framed. If you're dull, you can't be blamed. Mirror, mirror on the wall, you're irrelevant. That's all.
The use of the word reflect there twice, different, slightly different meanings, right? With the,
yes.
The mirror as a key
yes.
element. Beautiful.
This same book, Arts and Letters and Love, includes a section of poems inspired by books or single lines from books. This one was inspired by a line from The Great Gatsby, which, as most of you probably know, involves a doomed love affair between Gatsby and Daisy. The title of the poem, which is also the first line of the poem, describes Daisy. Her voice is full of money. After a line from F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. Her voice is full of money. His house is full of flash. The shoreline drips with honey. Their hearts both drip with ash. Her husband runs around, and she'll have her fun, too. Beside Long Island Sound, such news is hardly new. Her hats are broad and chic. His yellow car is bright. Their consciences are weak, and this won't be their night. I'm going to read a poem from my first book, The Truth in Dissonance. And this is a poem inspired by music, but not classical music this time. This is a rondeau, and the phrase you'll hear repeated is, Miss Rigby was. I hope you know who I'm referring to.
I got it. Big Beatles fan.
Rondeau for Miss Rigby, after Lennon and McCartney's Eleanor Rigby. Miss Rigby was not one to rue her fate. No moonlit rendezvous would make her one half of a pair. But she had learned how not to care. She dreamed, cleaned the church. She said a few hellos and more amens. She knew that seldom did a soul ask where Miss Rigby was. And as she dusted sconce and pew, her loneliness became a cue for violins in rhythmic prayer, although no one was really there, and no one ever would know who Miss Rigby was. I'm going to close with a poem from my newest book called Home and Away. It includes four kitchen sonnets. This one is called Dishwasher. O merciful magician who erases the evidence of all my gluttony. You drown the cookie crumbs, swallow the traces of Chardonnay, inhale the bits of brie. I hear your swishing, splashing incantation, the holy water swirling through the crud. But I can leave the room. No supplication or kneeling is required. No sweat, no blood. At cycle's end, a look inside reveals that if I'm not quite cleansed of sin, at least my dishes are. From my unbalanced meals, I'm as good as absolved, and with no priest. I've managed to gain spotless grace and hope by tithing just a little pod of soap.
Very nice. When you mentioned that you had kitchen sonnets, I thought that was perhaps a new form that I wasn't familiar with.
Nope, it's the old one.
Just a sonnet about the kitchen. Well, thank you, Jean, for sharing your work and your own take on the poet's voice. And thanks to our audience for joining us. Listeners, if you'd like to follow our program, remember to check your TIC listings for future broadcasts of the poet's voice.